I'd like to talk, as the previous speakers have, about baryons, but actually I'm going to focus on some baryons that haven't been discussed much so far, and those are the stellar baryons. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about stellar baryons that are not necessarily in the galaxies in the cluster, but between the galaxies in the cluster in the so-called intercluster light. And I'm also going to be talking about a wider range of masses, at least, than the first speaker spoke of. I'm going to be talking about not just monsters, but goblins, groups of galaxies. So just to leave you with a couple of quick sound bites about the intracluster medium, it's important. And in particular, as we've seen in some previous talks on the theory, a lot of the disagreement, at least at this point, and based on hydrodynamical simulations, is not showing up as much in the baryonic gas fractions or even in the trends with baryonic gas, but in the stellar fractions. So we really need to make sure we are making a full accounting of the stars in and outside of galaxies. And this plot gives you a sense of the scale of the problem. What you see here is a photometric image of a large, in this case, cluster of galaxies with its central brightest cluster galaxy. If you do some fancy footwork, fitting, and adaptive smoothing, you can see that in this case, the intracluster stars extend out to as far as a megaparsec around this system. And I just wanted to highlight two people I call my brightest cluster collaborators, or BCCs. They've done all the work. This is Anthony Gonzalez and Suresh Sivanandam. So if we want to briefly summarize what we're talking about when we're talking about intercluster light, it's something that is detectable with some effort and ubiquitous. We found it in every system, high and low mass, that we have looked at thus far. It is a distinct population of stars that responds to the potential of the cluster, not just that of the central galaxy. So there are, in effect, two components here in the surface brightness profile and in the kinematic, the orbits of these stars. And there's lots of it. And in particular, there is a lot more of it in lower mass systems. So it becomes very important in our accounting of the baryons. I'm going to completely skip the heroic efforts of Anthony in trying to measure this stuff, but I will just summarize by saying that for most of the observations I'm showing you today, we started an initial sky level and surface brightness of about 20 magnitudes per square arc second, and we detect this light at 5 sigma now down to about 27.5 magnitudes per square arc second. And in most of these systems, that's an equivalent physical radius of about 500 kpc or so. All right, well, why should you care? I already mentioned that intracluster stars are important. It's important always to account for all the baryons. But let me just summarize a few of the ways in which we have used intracluster stars to address some very interesting astrophysical questions. First of all, I mentioned that they trace the potential. And what's particularly interesting in light of this morning's discussion is that they trace the potential within the central 100 kiloparsecs of the system. And that is where there are currently disagreements as to the form of the mass profiles of clusters. I will not be talking about this today, but I would love to talk with anyone who will listen about work that we are doing using long slit and IFU spectroscopy to try to constrain the kinematics within the central 100 kiloparsecs using the intercluster stars. They do trace the potential of the cluster, though. They enrich the intercluster gas. It's been a problem for many years understanding why cluster, intercluster media, intergroup media are so enriched, 0.3 solar and the like. And yet, there's a whole population of stars that lie in situ, that enrich that intercluster medium in situ. You don't have to worry about ejecting stuff out of cluster galaxies with this population. The intercluster stars do help us to address the so-called missing baryon problem. As I mentioned, they tend to be a higher proportion of the stellar baryons in lower mass systems. And these are the systems where we might have inferred there to be baryons more difficult to detect. We really need to account for them there. And there's this interesting point that's been made in recent years with regard to the apparent lack of expected evolution at the bright end of the galaxy luminosity function in clusters. In particular, it's been noted that even though through mergers it's expected that the brightest cluster galaxies get built up by factors of 2 or so from redshift 1 to today, that has not been observed. And yet, if a lot of that material goes into an intercluster light component, which has heretofore been mostly hidden from observers and not accounted for, it's possible to close the loop on that particular question. Accounting for the population of intercluster stars and those inside galaxies, and comparing that to the gaseous baryons, especially as a function of halo mass, helps us to characterize how the star formation efficiency of different halos may or may not vary with mass. And as has been noted before, specifically by Lexi Vick-Linus, is that if there are trends in the gas baryon fraction, if there are trends in the stellar baryon fraction that are not what we would naively expect, for example, if the gaseous baryon fraction, if the number of gaseous baryons rise faster than the cluster mass does, or the number of stellar baryons falls faster than the cluster mass does, that starts to break a lot of the synergy between the SZ and the XZ and the X-ray trends that people have been assuming to do cluster cosmology. And it's very, very important to take account of those trends in understanding those results. Now, I'd like to show you just a quick movie of work that had been done a number of years ago by Chris Mijos and his student Carlo McBride. Just an n-body simulation of the hierarchical formation of a cluster. But what's interesting in this movie is that it shows you that galaxies in the groups primarily falling into the cluster are interacting with one another tidally, stripping stars from each other, and distributing intracluster stars within the groups, which then merge to form the cluster and its final population of intracluster stars. So you can see here that there are areas of intragalactic stellar formation. I'll run that one more time just to give you a feeling of what we're looking at here. And then ultimately, the system relaxes more or less, and you get a far-flung diffuse distribution of intercluster stars. But that's not quite where most of them were stripped. They were stripped in local overdense environments first. Okay, very briefly, here's what the surface brightness profile of intercluster stars looks like. This is what we were presented with when we first started doing this project. Our fits were actually in 2D. I'm showing you a 1D projection here just for ease of viewing. But if you take a look at, say, the surface brightness profile in a Bell 2571, and you ask whether or not it's possible to fit it with a single de Vaucouleurs profile, it's not. It does a very, very poor job at large radii on the semi-major axis of 100 or a few hundred kiloparsecs. Down here, keep your eye on these as well. I'm showing the ellipticity and position angle profiles as a function of radius. If we take the next step in complexity up and try a more generalized single Circe profile, well, you can do pretty well fitting the surface brightness profile of this cluster, extending out from this giant elliptical into the blue space that you're seeing, the blue light. It's not really blue. It's blue in this picture that you see here. But again, the single profile fails to represent the ellipticity and position angle profiles. So then what's the next order of complexity? Two de Vaucouleurs profiles. Now we're seeing the suggestion that there are, in fact, two components here. As I mentioned earlier, here's one of the elements of proof. And what you can see in this case is that finally we are matched to the ellipticity and position angle profiles in addition to the surface brightness profile. And this is just not a random view of a triaxial system in this case, because you would not see this kind of step-like behavior otherwise. All right, to summarize, what we've learned, and you haven't learned it yet because I haven't told you, but I can talk about it if you have questions. This is what, over the last few years, we feel we've learned about the intracluster light component in groups and in clusters. It's distinct and it's ubiquitous. If you consider it relative to the brightest cluster galaxies light, it's most of it. It's most of the combination of those two components. And this is a very fluffy number, this 40% of total baryons, because it varies so much depending upon the halo mass that you're talking about. So I give 40% as some figure that's about an average for the sample, but it can be 80% in a poor group of galaxies. It can be 20%, 10% in a very rich cluster of galaxies within our 500. We find that this extended stellar light component is aligned more often than not, more often than random, with the brightest cluster galaxy. It tends to be 10 to 40 times bigger in size than the brightest cluster galaxy, which is consistent with what we consider to be the scale of the cluster itself. It's more elliptical than the brightest cluster galaxy, again, consistent typically with the more elliptical distribution of cluster members. And as I mentioned before, these stars respond to the potential of the cluster. After you get out to about 10 kiloparsecs or so, you see the velocity dispersion in the integrated spectrum rise. We find through an analysis of the color gradients of these stars that the color gradients tend to be very similar. They tend to be very smooth. They tend to have colors consistent with old stars and metal poor progenitors, suggesting, as in the case of the simulation that I showed you earlier, that the intracluster stars may be stripped off in lower density environments where galaxy-galaxy interactions are common prior to them falling into cluster and the growth of that population slowing because of the increase in the relative motions of the galaxies in the cluster, making them less likely to do damage to one another. Okay, I mentioned the question of enrichment. And I want to show you some of the work that Suresh Sivanandam has done. All of you are familiar with a picture like this, an optical and an X-ray image of a cluster of galaxies. And as I had mentioned, one mystery has been why so many metals in the X-ray intracluster medium. And for many years, one had to jump through all sorts of hoops to get that many metals out of the cluster galaxies. And here we are talking about a population of stars that are there already. So anything they're going to do, evolution-wise, is immediately going to be put into the intracluster medium. So what Suresh did was consider this idea that perhaps some combination of these in-situ intracluster stars and metals ejected from galaxies might get you up to the kinds of metallicities that are characteristics of clusters and groups. And so what he did is he took an old stellar population model and evolved it to the point where it matched the luminosity of the intracluster light that we see today. The evolution of the stars in the models then told him how many supernovae they were. He assumed standard yields. He got predictions for how much iron that they were producing at each epoch. He integrated over all those redshifts and produced a prediction for how much iron should have been injected into the intercluster medium by the intercluster stars. And as a result of that measurement, what you can see in this plot is the ratio of the predicted iron from different components, whether it be the intracluster stars or the stars and galaxies, over the observed iron. So the target here in the total would be 1. And the question is, will this help balance the budget with regard to at least the iron content of clusters? And the answer was yes, that under fairly modest conservative assumptions, you can produce 30% of the iron within R500 observed in the intercluster medium, just with the intercluster stars and their evolution. To get to the point where the average for a sample, and this is a plot of the predictions versus the the velocity dispersion to get to the point where you actually have an average total number of predicted metals that is consistent with what is observed, we still had to have roughly 85% mass loss from the stars in galaxies. Now, that's not inconsistent with the metals actually retained by stars, but that's still a pretty hefty number. But as I'm sure many of you know, supernova rates are fairly uncertain at this juncture. Hopefully that won't always be the case. But if you actually take just the one sigma upper bound on the type 1a rates we assumed in his model, you can get the metal loss down to a more respectable and believable 35% and still have the average for the sample come out to the number of iron actually observed. Okay, well, let me talk baryon budget, because that's what everyone wants to hear. So this is our version of the plot you've seen many times already. What you're seeing in this case it's a WMAP 3 value. We've actually recently updated this for WMAP 7. It makes an incremental upward motion of our total baryon fraction of about 4.5%, so don't worry about that. But what you're seeing here is how the baryon fraction changes with mass in the original sample of groups and clusters that we put together. So this is a sample that roughly spans just under 10 to the 14th solar masses up to 10 to the 15th solar mass halos, systems, and their hot X-ray gas, and what's going on with the fractional contribution of that to the total mass, versus what their stars are doing, both intercluster stars and stars in galaxies. Let me just point out that at least in this original analysis, these were the measurements we made. And these measurements were from Alexei Viklinin's work. So these measurements were not made for the same clusters. And what you can see, however, when these trends were quantified and summed was something that surprised us. They were flat. And to me, this suggested that were there to be any significant population of missing baryons, we wouldn't have expected this line to be flat, the total baryon fraction as a function of mass of that. Because generally, you'd think that it would be easier to miss baryons in the relatively cool environment of groups of galaxies. And yet, it seemed on the basis of this that at most, we were missing about 20% of the baryons, because this line rested about 20% below the WMAP value at that time. And we actually, quite frankly, didn't lose sleep over that 20% deficit. One is these were all evaluated at R500. And Andre will tell you that you might expect some deficit relative to the universal value anyway. But two, as we all know, there are a whole lot of systematics in X-ray astronomy and perhaps in the determination of the stellar quantity. But generally, taking at face value, if you look at these opposing trends which compensate for one another and produce a flat total baryon relation, is that we have little, if any, undetected component in the baryons. The gas is up, the stars is down, so the star formation efficiency appears to decrease as you go to higher mass halos. All right, well, that's all very well, but we've done a better job now. So these are results from a new sample which Suresh and Anthony have put together just to indicate there are 8 systems now for which we have both intercluster light measurements and X-ray measurements. So the problem with having 2 trends for 2 different sets of data, at least for these 8 systems which are in this sort of mustard color, has now gone away. And what you can see is that in general, although our sample does not as yet span the dynamic range of the previous sample, but we're working on it, is that we get more or less the same values as before and the same trends as before. We're consistent with the trends as before. And one thing that I should point out, and I mentioned mustard, they're mustard up here in the ICM, but they're actually purple here in the total stars. They're mustard again back down here at WMAP. Is that we've actually moved up slightly, and we're now within about 10% of the WMAP value. So On the basis of this, I would say that it is not obvious that we are missing a whole lot of baryons. I would say we're within spitting distance now of WMAP 7 to the tune of 10% or so. And nor is there an indication that these trends no longer exist or don't compensate for one another. Okay. I'm actually going to skip through this for a moment, but I'd be happy to take questions about it. The thing that I wanted to stress in those plots was just to let you know that we see a very dramatic change in the ICL, in the intracluster light fraction with mass. And most of that change is actually governed by more and more stars in galaxies as you go to higher mass systems, and relatively fewer stars in the intracluster light as you go to higher mass systems. And that may be about this stripping efficiency. And when you start putting things in a cluster environment, how galaxies are less likely to strip and interact. If you put in a bunch of groups that have a large intracluster light population, and you add a bunch of groups that don't, and galaxies to the cluster, you end up with a system that may just have a low intracluster light fraction. And that's what we tend to see. So just to summarize, because I did want to make a parenthetical remark with respect to a lot of the models that we've been seeing. We see evidence for intracluster starlight in every system we've looked at. We can explain the iron content. We have baryon fractions that are consistent with, more or less, with universal values and constant in mass. Among the baryon phases, we see a sense in which the star formation efficiency decreases with increasing mass. And this I mentioned but didn't show you, there are fewer intracluster stars and more galactic stars, a lot more galactic stars, a lot fewer intracluster stars as you go to higher masses. And what ends up happening in that case is you could argue that the growth of the intracluster light via stripping stalls at some mass level. I did want to mention that we're pushing the sample a lot further. We just put in a WIF, as I think some people did, a WIF 3 IR proposal to actually sample more groups to extend our dynamic range into a place where the intracluster light seriously matters. These are groups compared to the class clusters. This is the distribution of temperatures. This is the distribution of redshifts. The groups we're proposing to do all have intracluster light, the potential for making intracluster light measurements, and do have X-ray data. And I did want to say, as Andre had said earlier, that the models need to match these baryon trends, and that these trends themselves have real implications for cosmology with clusters, especially if things don't rise as steeply as the cluster mass does or fall more steeply than the cluster mass does. It's possible that, Alexei had pointed out, that the fair sample hypothesis is not right, taken at face value, applied to these trends, and that they have to be included. So I will end there, but do I have a few more minutes? Because I did want to make a few. Okay. Can I take one more minute? Okay. I just wanted to make a few comments because there's been a lot of discussion about baryon fraction at mass at this meeting, and I wasn't sure how much discussion there would be, so I didn't put this in the bulk of the talk, but I was pleasantly surprised and encouraged. At any rate, I'm just reproducing a plot that Andre had made for his white paper on the subject, and we've all seen this before. The point to take away here is gray is WMAP, blue is theoretical predictions with feedback, and green are our old points, which our new points support. And the interesting thing here is this could be the same old cooling problem or variant thereof that have existed in simulations for some time, in that the simulations appear to overpredict the stellar baryon fraction generally, and particularly in high mass systems. And it could also be, though, that we're just not doing something right. And I just wanted to mention a few of the ways in which we could be messing up and what we could do or think about those things. this would imply that we're missing stellar baryons in clusters, not as many as in groups. That's kind of weird, all right, to begin with. We can't be missing too many or the cluster values would go to super WMAP. If we're missing stellar baryons in clusters, there are basically three possibilities. We're missing stellar baryons in galaxies, we're missing intracluster stars, or we're dealing with a sample of non-representative clusters, unlike those that are actually being drawn from the simulations. I just want to briefly say that Sand et al. In his results, I keep saying briefly, and I'm not being brief, but I do have till 3, right? No, I don't? Oh, this was the question section. Okay, 30 more seconds. I wanted to say that the fraction of stars in the intracluster light that we're measuring is supported by recent work looking at supernovae rates in intracluster stars. So any studies that argue that the stellar baryon fraction is more shallow than this have not included the ICL or who have assumed that the ICL, the intracluster light, is constant with mass. You can't assume either of those things. So the only thing that we could really be left with is that we could be talking about a sample that's unrepresentative, because I don't really feel that we're worse at finding galactic stars in clusters than we are in groups. That's a tough thing to swallow. And the ICL is not the problem. Well, maybe some people disagree, we can talk about it. But I think one thing to consider is that we've picked BCG-dominated, very relaxed systems for this whole analysis. And I think it's incumbent on us to find out, and the simulators to find out, if there's any way in which the total number of stars in such systems could be biased low. I think the simulators should be selecting this kind of system, though. Not any old cluster from the simulations, but the ones that are just like the ones people are using to make these measurements, and they are a special class of objects. They're not even most of them. So I just wanted to stress that this is the final the point that I wanted to make.
Thank
that
you.
I keep saying that too. If you include the ICL or you make your measurement in a region of little ICL, people are converging on getting this steep a stellar mass relation. So I think this difference is going to stand. The question is, are we comparing apples to apples? Thank you.
So I think, thank you very much, Anne. One first question for Anne, and then we can start the general discussion. Stefan and Steven, would you like to join us here to animate the discussion? And
I have a question back to cosmology. It's not about baryon fractions. So is that okay?
Do you have questions about Ernstorff? Yeah. Okay, he was first. I will go with him, and then I have you in mind, and we will take all the questions.
So I have a question about the metal enrichment with the intercluster stars. So have you considered the alpha elements as well as iron? Because I think X-ray observations have shown pretty clearly that the general, once you get beyond the BCG, it's been enriched by type 2 supernovae, not type 1A. And so you get the wrong mix of abundances if you just consider the strip stars. So I don't see that can do it.
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And I mean, this alpha element problem exists even in galaxies. And we have to be very careful then how we're effectively weighting the Bryce cluster galaxy into this mix and to get spatially resolved X-ray measurements of the metallicity in that case. I was just going to say, at the time we did Suresh's work, we weren't quite there yet. I think this is the time to explore that. I completely agree. We mentioned in the paper it would be a great thing to do, but it would have been pushing the measurements we had. But I think we're there. I think that's an excellent question.
If I look in a little bit older literature on BCGs, like the work of Schombat, you find that he finds BCGs which have a large halo, and he finds BCGs without a large halo. Is that now out? Do modern data not support it anymore? Or if it's true, what does it do to your baryon budget model?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, Schombat's work stood in its position for a very, very long time. I think
By the time you get out to that particular claim, you're dealing in a realm, he's working with photometric vertigraphic plates, where the sky background dominated a level that was not fully taken into account in the measurements. So we simulated a lot of the work that he did, and it turned out that you would just not be sensitive to any difference of that kind with the material that he had to work with. So I can only tell you that in any system that we have looked at, we see the second component that is extended. We have only looked in those systems that were selected to be giant honkin ellipticals in the centers of groups and clusters of galaxies. So in some sense, these are maximal intercluster light objects. And it's one of the points I wanted to make. There are issues with selection. And I think there are objects where we can actually get these kinds of measurements, so we may be stuck with them. And then it's incumbent on the simulators to pick those out in some sense from the simulation. You want to jump in?
Okay.
My comment is that we don't need to care about intercluster light for cosmology reason. The reason is very simple. The intercluster light is a fine fraction of the total light. If you take a small area in the cluster, but how much mass there is there? Very little in the cluster. So as soon as you take a representative volume of the cluster, you are not looking at the very center. The fraction of intercluster light is 10%, and so you have not to really care about it. If in addition to that, you start to not to put in the word intercluster light what is tied to the galaxy. For example, the galaxies which are too faint to be detected individually, the outer halo of the galaxy that you have not detected up to the end of the galaxy, this 10% became 2%. What the relevance of 2% of star here, or even here, on the total baryon budget? Zero.
Well, can I respond to your response? That's what I thought.
So, I think we should go a bit to the audience, yeah.
Just very briefly, I certainly agree that when you select systems with bigger BCGs, they should have more ICL, but they also should have less light in their satellite populations. So that will bias your overall stellar mass fraction in galaxies. That's what I would predict.
Is there some budget in that we only have the same amount of stellar mass in that case, or is it more
or less? I think it's biased.
I don't think we know that yet.
Okay.
So I think I need to select the sample which is independent of the optical. So the sample is not selected to have a BCG inside. So you get again the same fraction.
Okay, so there is a question on cosmology here. They're waiting for this.
This is getting heated, so back to cosmology. So Steve, Alan nicely explained the F-gas method, and I have, I guess, more of a comment on not only on that, but on any cosmological analysis. I think you implied that your systematic analysis was extremely conservative. And I guess I would only take issue in that in all your so-called nuisance parameters that vary as a function of redshift and so on, you have assumed a monotonic mean relation that's described with a Gaussian bias, and then you have those biases and you're marginalizing over them. But as far as I can tell, the universe has no reason why to create smooth relations, and certainly why not to create why to create the Gaussian bias, which is a set of measures zero, of course, in the space of possibilities. So I think, in other words, you are self-calibrating these parameters, and I would argue maybe one shouldn't allow them to be self-calibrated, but rather introduce a larger number of parameters that make everything blow up, and then put prior on them as to how much they allow to be from. And then one is in a different ball game. Maybe the results still survive, but that's a different kind of game one's doing.
I think it's a fair point, Dragon, I think it's a fair point that we should be as conservative in general as possible. And it's true for that analysis there. We went one step beyond by allowing linear. We played with allowing quadratic as well. David Rapetti had a play with that. It didn't make too much difference. But yeah, we'd really like as much help from simulators as possible in instructing us, in guiding us in the right priors to use in trying to encompass the range of the true range of uncertainty here. And asking the right question, I think, is the most difficult thing, to make sure we ask the right question. So I agree with the sentiment.
Steve, I also had a question on this method. So if you think about trying to use larger X-ray samples or maybe an SC sample and trying to apply your F-gas method, how much is it a problem if you start injecting a few of these non-relaxed systems into it? So how much does that screw up the accuracy of these very precise measurements?
What it should do, quite simply, is throw in measurements that have larger systematic scatter. We would expect, if we have an unrelaxed system based on simulations, to have 20% bias and 20% scatter in the mass, and so it should stick out like a sore thumb in the F-gas measurements. You won't get the very tight scatter.
I'll take advantage of the microphone before me. It's again for about the intracluster light. I would say that this is one of the few cases in which I'm surprised by the level of agreement between what simulations predicted and what observations found for the intracluster light. I'm tempted to comment on several points, but I will just pick up one. So this story of the enrichment is actually very nice. Back in 2007, I think we predicted that there should be a substantial diffuse enrichment from an old population for diffuse intracluster light. Okay. But the problem that we faced, however, was again along the line that Brian was mentioning, that if you have that the stars in the intracluster light are mostly the releasing elements associated with long-lived stars, okay, then as you move to the center of the cluster, you should observe a gradient in the oxygen over iron or whatever, alpha over iron, that we don't observe in X-rays. So it's true that the population of intracluster light should provide diffuse enrichment of iron or whatever, while in the center you should have more oxygen or alpha elements, but unfortunately we don't see in X-rays. So I don't know why, but I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent question, and I don't think that's entirely been resolved. I mean, I think there are perhaps physical processes that would help mix or diffuse that, which, again, haven't been adequately modeled. I think the data are only now to the point where these sorts of predictions can be made, but I think it's a very good question. I don't know.
All right, so I'll ask it. This very steep trend, F star, it's true also if you cut out your ICL, right? You have a very steep trend even with the satellites, as I recall. If you plot up Anthony's...
Sorry, the satellite?
Yeah, so if you add up just a stellar mass in galaxies, it's still very steep. Giardini found that as well, for example, similarly steep things. Now, that's interesting that there's agreement between those two studies and with Stefano's as well. But I can name at least as many other observational studies, recent ones, finding flattish things, right?
Which ones?
Right over here, Yen-Ting Lin here. He finds a much shallower. It's still a gradient, but it's much shallower. That's one, okay. There's the abundance matching stuff, right, that people have been doing. Risa can tell you about that. She's back there in the audience. Okay. And then there's Mike Ballo's group. So you mentioned the intracluster stars.
He's actually found that the intracluster stars...
It's 40%, yes, but when you add it in...
It was a the supernovae, right?
Yeah. But it's still, he finds a total stellar mass fraction of 1% and that it's not very strong function of stellar mass. He does.
Okay, I would disagree, but nevertheless, go ahead.
So that's three studies there that find very flat things just in the stars. So this has nothing to do with intracluster light. People are disagreeing about the stellar mass in galaxies. And so I would say that rather than it being an issue for simulators to sort out, there is an issue for simulators, there's also an equally large issue for observers to sort out.
You're talking about, for example, what's assumed by different studies with regard to the mass, the stellar mass to light ratio as well.
That's a big part of it. That's a big part of it.
But for example, what we use in this case is a mass to light of 3.6, which is consistent with the Soron values for giant early type galaxies.
So what the Cosmos people do are doing 30 band photometry,
but if
right?
We go to, if we go to Van Dokkum and Conroy, which is a higher number, or we take it down by a factor of a little bit within the experimental range, it does not affect these results.
But
that's the thing. I mean, you can take the observed. But
that don't. Look, I'm just telling you that other observers who are doing the same thing as you are finding flash. And all they're doing is doing the same thing, assuming a fixed mass to light ratio. And so. This is your paper. I can take other papers.
Okay, do you have other questions about interstellar on this subject? Is it the first question? Okay, so if we go to Steve talk, I think there is first a question here, a question there, and that.
All right, yeah, that's a comment on Steve's new result, and that's a great story for cluster cosmology that, you know, we see how F-gas approaches the WMAP value at large radii. The problem I have is the reasoning how you arrived to this. So somehow you see in Perseus that F-gas approaches the WMAP value even without including stars at R500. And so you assume that there's no problem up to R500, and then it shoots over this WMAP value, and your inference is that you know, somehow clumpiness sinks in at this radius, but it reaches the WMAP value at R500 and keeps rising at this point. This means locally at that radius, if you consider the ratio of gas density to the total mass density, it should be way over the WMAP value. So do we have, instead of baryon, missing baryon problem, do we have an excess baryon problem with this radius?
Right, yeah. So at first glance, I would agree. At first glance, it would look like you may have an excess baryon problem. I would say if we just had the F-gas profile alone that I showed you, I would feel less sure about what I'm saying, although there are indications there that already point to it. The thing that makes us feel confident that we have the right picture with regard to this clumping, that there's no problem with there being extra baryons, is the combination of the F-gas profile and also the entropy profiles and pressure profiles that Aurora was showing. The fact that that clumping appears to cut in at a I think it's about 0.4, 0.45 R200. So even inside R500, clumping appears to be starting to have an effect. And if you account for it, it just puts the pressure in the right place, the entropy in the right place, the F-gas makes sense. And those are very different multiplications or divisions, factors of N and T that are all suddenly making sense. So my take is that no, we don't have an excess of baryons, at least there's no evidence for it. We have very strong evidence that clumping plays an important role even before we get to R500, but not at R2500. And I think it was even you that was making a point, we should think very carefully about where the sweet spot to make our measurements for our cosmology studies lie.
Okay, Steve, this is for you. So, together with Silvia Galli, who's a student of mine, we've been looking at sort of the future of F-gas and where we think we can go. And we phrased the question in the following way, and I want to ask it to you because I know you thought a lot about this as well. Supposing somebody gave you, let's say, 50 clusters, new ones, what redshift range would you put them at, and what do you think that would bring to the final?
So that's a really good question. And again, it takes us back to the point of the most important thing here to think about, I think, once we have the mechanics, we know how to do things, is to think about the question that we want to ask. And the optimal set, the optimal redshift to put those clusters at depends upon the question that you're interested in asking of the data. If you just want to constrain W and you're willing to say W must be constant, you'd shove them all at low redshift because it would be cheap to do it and you'd get a really, really excellent answer. If you want to allow, you can see where I'm going. add more possibilities into the question and your answer changes. And so I think it behooves us to try to reach out in Redshift, because we know that there are theoretical uncertainties that could lead to interesting cosmological effects at those redshifts. So I would want to probe the type of redshifts that your and other SZ surveys are getting to, as well as getting more data at low redshift to really beat down that anchor. We want an anchor at low and intermediate and to probe high redshift.
Sylvia found during her research was that, in fact, for the simple dark energy models, 0.3
is
a real sweet spot, surprisingly enough.
I agree with you, and we should get data at 0.3, but you know, we have a lot of questions we like to ask of these data.
Okay, so I think we have to close the section, and thank you very much, all the speakers, and thank you for your excellent questions.